did to the National Institute of Arts and Letters, he made light of it with the ditty, "Rudy Toot, ah, Rudy Toot, oh, we're the members of the Institute." But he had great respect for ceremony and recognition, and in the years following, he proposed nominations and citations for dozens of other writers whose work he admired. Certainly it is in the work that one comes to know an author, his best and essential self, without being able to extricate or explain him. "A short story is the appeasement of pain," said Cheever, who felt the story form possessed an intensity the novel did not. In a stuck ski lift, a sinking boat, a dentist's office, or a doctor's office, at the very point of death, one tells oneself a short story. Donaldson lingers in his discussion of Cheever's great stories, "Goodbye, My Brother," "The Country Husband," "The Geometry of Love," like a gardener caring for them, though in his particular tasks they yield him beauty rather than fruit. Said son Fred Cheever of his father, "No one, absolutely no one, shared his life with him." Donaldson has this in common with his subject, the impulse to share a life that cannot be shared. Though it can be written down a little with a gardener's care, the words planted like a kiss. 1988. Bobby Ann Mason's Love Life. Bobby Ann Mason writes the kind of fiction her own characters would never read. If they turn off the television long enough to look at a book at all, her characters are inclined toward the seamy gothic romances they themselves refer to as bodice busters. "I don't read," says one Mason character. "If I read, I just go crazy." This puts the Kentucky-born Mason in that lonesome and literary position of being neither wholly of the world about which she writes, nor of the world to which she writes. Most of her shorter work has appeared in The New Yorker. In this middle place, no axes to grind, no self is mythologized, no isms truly suit. She writes from a slight and only slightly unsafe distance, a place of friendly irony, and her pen neither condescends nor skewers. She is gentle with her good country people, whose idea of wickedness is to park at the mall in a handicapped parking spot, in a way that Flannery O'Connor, with whom Mason is sometimes strangely compared, could never have been. But she hesitates to prettify, to flash the ruby in the rube. Declining to dismantle them, to judge them, to be them, Mason seems to have simply collected her characters, collected the stuff of them, collected, in the insular spirit of the curator or the spy, what she knows, rather than what she thinks. Which is why Mason's strongest form may be neither the novel nor the story, but the story collection. It is there, picking up her pen every 20 pages to start anew, gathering layers through echo and overlap, that Mason depicts most richly a community of contemporary lives, which is her great skill. It could be argued that the quiet, cumulative beauty of Mason's Shiloh and other stories is rivaled in her oeuvre, which includes the novels In Country and Spence and Lila, only by her new collection, Love Life. There is depth here in the way the word is used to describe armies and sports teams, an accumulation, a supply. When one story is finished, a similar one rushes in to fill its place. There is also profundity. Mason dips her pen in the same ink over and over, because her knowledge of the landlocked middle America she writes about, most of it centered in Kentucky and Tennessee, is endless and huge. Each small story adds to the reader's apprehension of that hugeness. In Mason's new collection, her themes of provincial entrapment and desire are present again, but here she has given them a new improvisatory sprawl. Though a few of the 15 stories in Love Life, such as the title one, repeat the figure-eight structure found in Shiloh, a narrative that loops gracefully through several combinations of characters, then arches back to the original one, many of the stories in Love Life splay out unexpectedly, skate off or in at odd angles, displaying a directional looseness. Midnight Magic introduces the dramatic threat of a town terrorized by an unknown rapist, but then ends off to one side of it, with the moral dilemma over the reporting of a hit-and-run accident. Piano Fingers begins with a husband's sexual boredom and ends with a father buying his daughter an electric keyboard from the piano store. Certainly the beginnings and endings do illuminate each other, but only indirectly, diffusely. Along the way, elements are seldom developed in a linear fashion and are often, once introduced, abandoned altogether. But this unexpectedness keeps Mason's stories breathing and alive. Her writing is naked-voiced, without vanity. In State Champions, a memory of small-town adolescence, the middle-aged narrator is made to understand belatedly and obliquely the significance of her high school basketball team's state championship. 20 years after the fact, someone not from her community recollects for her. "Why, they were just a handful of country boys who could barely afford basketball shoes," the man told me in upstate New York. "They were? This was news to me." Which leads, circuitously, to one of Mason's strongest stories about the emotional illiteracy of the provincial heart. The narrator recalls her teenage crush on a boy who gives her an 8-page novel, a slightly off-color Little Abner comic strip. "It was disgusting, but I was thrilled that he showed me the booklet." When her best friend's sister dies, the narrator remembers avoiding her. "I didn't know what to say. I couldn't say anything, for we weren't raised to say things that were heartfelt and gracious. We didn't say we were sorry. We hid from view, in case we might be called on to make appropriate remarks, the way certain old folks in church were sometimes called on to pray. At Cuba school, there was one teacher who, for punishment, made her students write, 'I love you,' 500 times on the blackboard. Love was a dirty word, and I had seen it on the walls of the girls' restroom, blazing there in ugly red lipstick. In the 8-page novel Glenn had showed me, Little Abner said, 'I love you,' to Daisy May." What can and cannot be said is always at issue in Mason's small towns. "If you don't want to hear about it, why don't you say so?" begins the story, Private Lies. Psychological inarticulateness is everywhere. A conversation about death can quickly become a conversation about shoes. In The Secret of the Pyramids, the fatal car accident of the protagonist's former lover is discussed this way. Then Glenda says, "Oh, wasn't that awful about Bob Morganfield? I know, I heard about it on the news last night. But he was so nice, everybody liked him. I got these shoes at his store this spring. I just love those. I wish I could wear spike heels." In Big Bertha Stories, a man tells his wife about a young woman he knew in Vietnam. "What happened to her?" asks the wife.
"I don't know."
"Is that the end of the story?"
"I don't know."
Later, the wife, thinking of her husband, realizes that her own sympathies have gone mute from neglect and inexpression. She hasn't thought of him as himself. She wasn't brought up that way, to examine someone's soul. Says a character in another story, "On moonlighting, they just talk, talk, talk. It drives you up the wall." For an edifying word on their troubles, Mason's characters watch The Phil Donahue Show, where they find the various problems of their lives formulated for them. A woman in the story Hunktown says, "I can't stand watching stuff that's straight out of my own life." They seem to share a startling belief that their lives correspond to the television culture that has descended on them. But it is more hope than belief, a desire to refashion and locate themselves, to medicate their feelings of exile with cheap understanding. For a good time, they go to Paducah or Gatlinburg. At a museum there, she saw a violin made from a ham can. They work in mattress factories or plant tobacco, and when they brush up against glamour and wealth, it is in the form of people who own hot tubs or their own bush hog rental company. For spirituality, there is the local Christianity. He opens the Bible and reads from the Philippines, which may also include speaking in tongues. He is speaking a sing-song language made of hard, disturbing sounds. Sheki bekpi floitai sheki tibilibi. Deb krila krula kro. He seems to be trying hard not to say abracadabra or any other familiar words. Only one Mason character ventures off to a therapist whom she calls the rapist, because the word therapist can be divided into two words, the rapist. When he tells her that perhaps she is trying to escape reality, she says, "Reality, hell! Reality's my whole problem!" Mason's women tend to be practical, disillusioned, self-preserving. They belong to cosmetics clubs, wear too much makeup, have names such as Beverly or Jolene. They are trapped mostly in their desire for Mason's men, who tend to be feckless, dreamy, drunk, between jobs. The sexes are a puzzle to each other here, and longing and distraction pervade their lives. Divorce seems the only remedy for a life where a couple stayed married like two dogs locked together in passion, except it wasn't passion. Mason's use of the present tense in the majority of her stories serves as the expression of this trapped condition, but also as a kind of existential imperfect. The freeze in time suggests the flow. The moment stilled and isolated from the past and future is yet emblematic of them both, of the gray ongoingness of things. Nevertheless, the characters in Love Life seemed determined to amuse themselves. In Private Lies, he liked to clown around, singing the Star-Spangled Banner in a mock operatic style. He would pretend to forget the words and then shift abruptly into "Carry Me Back to Old Virginia." He was a riot at parties. In The Secret of the Pyramids, the last time he took her out to eat, they had to wait for their table, and Bob gave the name Beach, so the hostess would call out on the microphone, "Beach party?" In Memphis, "I'm having a blast too," Beverly said, just as an enormous man with tattoos of outer space monsters on his arms asked Jolene to dance. Their days are punctuated with attenuated joys and generosities. The large gestures of life are reduced by Mason to the smallest scale, inflaming them with meaning. Steve's friend Pete squirts blue fluid on Steve's windshield, a personal service not usually provided at the self-serve island. Midnight magic. If such living is morally hemmed in, strewn with the junk of our culture, it is all that Mason's characters can avail themselves of. Buried in the very gut of America, feeling deeply the lock and cage of the land, they send up antennae and receive what they are able to, what there is. If they are mocked and demeaned by what they consume, they do not know it. To mock and demean are coastal pastimes, of which they haven't the spiritual or material means to partake. Liz wished she could go to the ocean, just once in her life, one narrator says. That was what she truly wanted. Despite the immodest imperative of its title, this wonderful collection is less about the optimist's advice to love life than about the struggle and necessity of some ordinary and valiant people to like it just a little. 1989. V.S. Pritchett's A Careless Widow. Sir Victor Sauden Pritchett is 89 years old this year, bringing to a close the seventh decade of a huge literary career. Over three dozen books, biographies of Turgenev and Balzac, volumes of criticism, novels, travel writing, autobiography, and now yet another collection of short fiction, A Careless Widow. Such an event might be construed as literary miracle or professional reproof, instead of what it more likely is, the natural happening of a life of letters lived totally, without ever being faked. The son of lower middle-class parents, V.S. Pritchett, grew up in a rough neighborhood of London, the setting of a somewhat Dickensian childhood. At times he and his brother lived as street urchins, the family home next to a loud mechanized bakery and a clattering roller skating rink. As a young man wanting to write, he languished briefly in the leather trade before escaping first to France, then to Ireland and Spain. Almost an exact contemporary of Hemingway, Pritchett, too, was in Paris in the 1920s and Spain in the 30s, and he might have sought out and joined the other writers' gathering in those places, but he didn't. Instead, he went his own way, receiving in 1975 a knighthood for distinguished services to literature, outliving, outproducing them all. Although critics wrangle over whether he has written a major novel, debating in particular the merits of Mr. Belluncle, 1951, there is no question as to the power and accomplishment of Pritchett's memoirs. A Cab at the Door, 1968, and Midnight Oil, 1971, nor of the greatness of his short stories. It was always the short story form to which Pritchett returned most inspired. He has compared writing stories to ballad making, and one thinks of the Pritchett story not only as an orchestration of ironies, but as a place where the author's sentences can do their humble, musical dazzle. "I've always liked the hard and sequined sheen of London streets at night," he wrote in the famous story, "Handsome Is as Handsome Does. The cars come down them like rats." Pritchett has confessed to whittling many of his stories down from 100-page novellas, and one can sometimes feel in his narratives the effect of that shrinkage, a strolling gait abruptly tensing, then relaxing again, a pulse in the prose. His stories have been called traditional, and he is often and aptly compared to Chekhov and Maupassant. Classically, a Pritchett story uses visitors or trips to disrupt the neatness or presumption of neatness in a character's life. He is a very English fiction of irony arrayed, hypocrisy exposed, eccentricity embraced. He captures the frustration and strain beneath the moral order of the average citizen, and he is nothing if not funny. Yet his humor never stiffens or distorts. His prose is always limpid, amused, but not muddied by bemusement. A Careless Widow is a collection of six stories, quiet and deceptively simple, like walks. In A Trip to the Seaside, a widower makes a futile journey to court his former secretary, only to be confronted with portions of their past he has selectively set aside. In Things, an older couple is paid a visit by the wife's witch-like and recalcitrant sister, whose improvised life rebukes their own, now congealing around the comforts and objects of bourgeois retirement. In A Careless Widow, a solitary hairdresser takes a holiday to escape the dreary routine of his professional life. Women came to him to be changed, to be perfected. They arrived tousled and complaining, and they left transfigured, equipped for the hunt again. They were simply top-knots to him. When they got up, he was always surprised to see they had legs and arms and could walk. He sometimes, though not often, admired the opposite end of them, their shoes. Such escape is possible for less than a day before he discovers his London neighbor, the widow of the title, staying at the same hotel. That was too much. She was ordinary life, and ordinary life always went too far. In all these stories, the past figures as a kind of character, a foil, a catalyst, a wise fool. Pritchett's people are well on their way out of middle age, but they do not feel old. Their relationship to the past is often unformed, unclear, yet to be negotiated. "It's a mistake to go back to the past. I mean, at my age, our age," says the careless widow. "Appetites still abound." She looked at him greedily, intently. The refrain, "even now," is sighed like an old and bittersweet joke. In Cocky Ollie, the narrator's thoughts journey irretrievably into her past, seemingly because she has refused, actually bodily, to take the trip to the places of her childhood, places she passes on her way to and from London. "One of these days, when there is no one with me, I plan to go and look at these places, but I never do," she says. And so the story becomes enmeshed in a long childhood memory, never to return to the present time. Then it was Cocky Ollie again, she says, ending the story with a favorite childhood game. And all of us racing around. Situated, however sentimentally or awkwardly, in the rolling landscape of the past, a Pritchett character can turn aback to death. The author himself looks at death, if not squarely, at least wryly. It is his bleak jest that in the title story, The Local Topography, offers a place called The Coffin for ambitious climbers. In the bleakly comic A Change of Policy, love and death attempt to outwit each other in bizarre plot shifts. A printer, his wife Ethel, a comatose stroke victim, falls in love with Paula, an editor for whom Ethel was once a secretary. "I've the feeling that I've been standing up all night for years," he tells his new love. In her guilt, Paula pays the wife a visit in the hospital. There was a sudden crash of oxygen cylinders that were being unloaded from a truck in the yard outside. The eyes did not move. Suddenly it occurred to Paula to speak in a peremptory office voice. "Ethel," she said. There was no movement in the eyes. Just as the title suggests, circumstances change abruptly in this story, and nothing brings Ethel back from death's jaws faster than her husband's sudden death after a horseback riding accident. In yet another curious turn, the two women become close friends, taking a cottage together in another village. Death is turned aback on. The past, practically and resourcefully, is made unusable in the present. In the final story, The Image Trade, Pearson, a famous older writer, perhaps not unlike Pritchett, must contend with a photographer intent on capturing his image for posterity, a kind of death mask. "You will miss all the et cetera of my life," the writer says. "I am all et cetera. My face is nothing. At my age, I don't need it. It is no more than a servant I push around before me. It knows nothing. It just collects. I send it to smirk at parties, to give lectures. It calls people by the wrong names. It is an indiscriminate little grinner. It kisses people I've never met. I know I have a face like a cup of soup with handles sticking out. What wouldn't I give for bone structure, a nose with a bone in it?" The picture he finally sees is a quiet marbling of death and life. "No sparkling anemone there, but the bald head of a melancholy frog, its feet clinging to a log, floating in literature. O fame," cried Pearson, "O Maupassant, O tales of Hoffman, O Edgar Allan Poe, O Grub Street." One feels keenly in these stories a master's presence, sharp and even as that longed-for nose with bone in it. Pritchett's is a literature of deep humanity, a mature artist's extension of affection into unexpected corners, a lover's unflagging interest in life. "I looked at the heads of all the people in the room," one of his narrators says. "They seemed to be like people from another planet. I was in love with them all and did not want to leave." 1989. Stanley Elkins, The MacGuffin. Stanley Elkins' novels have sometimes been criticized for their disregard of form and organized plot, for what some might see as their overindulgence in the author's poetic gift, his besotted high style. In The MacGuffin, that mad Joycean poetry is, pleasurably enough, still there. The sentences are long riffs of jazz, the words swarm and lather, the prose is exuberantly betroped, exhilaratingly de trop. One imitates it badly. But more self-consciously than in his previous novels, which include The Living End and George Mills, Elkin has placed at the thematic heart of his book a discussion of this failure of his at narrative construction. The title may say it all. The MacGuffin, a term used by Alfred Hitchcock, refers to that element in a Hitchcock film, or in narrative generally, that is a mere pretext for a plot. The MacGuffin might be the papers the spies are after, the secret theft of a ring, any device or gimmick that gets the plot rolling. The plot, moreover, is simply a pretext for an exploration of character, The MacGuffin itself has little, if any, intrinsic meaning. The MacGuffin, said Hitchcock, is nothing. In Elkin's novel, however, the MacGuffin appears to be a strangely metamorphosing idea. Or perhaps it is a fixed idea in an absurdly shifting world. One thinks of the joke from which the MacGuffin is presumed to have derived its name. Two men are on a train. What is that package? Asks one. That's a MacGuffin, answers the other. What's a MacGuffin?
It's for trapping lions in the Scottish Highlands.
But there are no lions in the Scottish Highlands.
Well then, that's no MacGuffin.
As personified in Elkin's novel, the MacGuffin is the muse of his plotline, the odd displacements, the skewed idiosyncratic angle. It is an imagined voice, an inner imp, a guardian devil to the novel's protagonist, Bob O'Druff, commissioner of streets in a mid-size American city. Druff, at 58, has lost his ease and wants it back. The way some people wanted their youth. He is experiencing a kind of aphasia, or Alzheimer's, or the beginnings of senility. Something dark was going on in the old gray matter, some sluggish white stupidity forming and hardening there like an impression formed in a mold. Druff's MacGuffin is the ordering force of paranoia, the seeing and making of plots, the reading of symbols in municipal routine, the straining after coincidence and story. There are things that have set Druff up for this dementia, this alcoholic vaudeville. There are the coca leaves in his pocket, there is his deteriorating health, and there is his guilty conscience. He has committed adultery. He has taken graft. He feels he will be found out. The hair tars and breath shellacs. The intimate cheeses and bitters will give him away. If you've asked for the bribe, they generally give you up to 3 weeks per thousand, Druff told his worried son Mikey, who is 30 and still lives at home. If you've been bribed, they usually let you off with a fine. It's your dad's policy only to accept bribes.
I know that, Mikey says. It's what all those fines could do to your net worth.
What preoccupies Druff and his MacGuffin the most is the death of Mikey's girlfriend, a Shiite Muslim named Suad, who has been killed in a hit-and-run accident. Druff himself once lusted after her just a bit while she held forth about the Shiite cause.
It all sounds to me like your typical power grab, he once told her. We see it time and again down at the hall.
The local here stands for the universal. As commissioner of streets, Druff must find out why Suad has died in one of them. Could it have been a faulty traffic light? In Elkin's world, there is nothing more complicated or simpler than municipal America. The time span of this chapterless narrative is approximately 2 days, and in that period, Druff spends many hours being driven around the city by his chauffeur, Dick the Spy, fantasizing himself the victim of sting operations, reminiscing about the days when he first met his wife, who had managed to turn her scoliosis into a lewd suggestion, and discussing with Dick the strange traffic in the middle of the night.
It's the nurses, says his driver, the spy. They come on at 7 at night. It's experimental. It plays hell with their menses, unless they have the middle shift, the 11-7 one, but the thinking today is that PMS gives them an edge.
To which Druff can only ask, is this true? Everything to him, a man old enough to be from a generation that still marveled that there were car radios, has begun to seem plausible, equally convincing or unconvincing. This is particularly true of Suad's death. Did she smuggle rugs or legitimately import them? And what did she want with Mikey? She was very devout, into that stuff like a terrorist. And his son planned on going back to Lebanon with her.
I was going to let them make me a hostage, he tells his father.
But Druff finally learns that minutes before her death, Suad attended a lecture by an Arab congressman from the state of Delaware, with whose conciliatory views Suad was in strong disagreement. The congressman, referring to our Israeli cousins,
stressed the necessity for all sides to dedicate themselves to solutions in the troubled Mideast. Angry, Suad stood up and made a heated reference to a need for final solutions. An hour later, she was dead. There is no mystery solved here, no sacred story set like a table, not really. Elkin is brilliant, but in his own brilliant way. His vision is not, as the generals have referred to the Persian Gulf War, scenario-dependent. It is less hollow, more nervous than that. "Life is either mostly adventure, or it's mostly psychology," says the voice of the MacGuffin before it takes its leave of Druff. "If you have enough of the one, then you don't need a lot of the other." The MacGuffin, then, is not only an Elkin-esque portrait of the sorrows of the body and the moral perils of work, it is a plea for the power of talk, for talk as its own resolution. Even Druff's manic, rapid mouth movement, all simile and parentheses and searching stammer, the DJ yak of the heart. Even this verbiage, the novel seems to say, perhaps especially this verbiage, this incoherence, is an intimacy, a negotiation, a prayer against death, a stay against war. 1991. Don DeLillo's Mao Tu. If terrorists have seized control of the world narrative, if they have captured the historical imagination, have they become, in effect, the world's new novelists? For sheer influence over the human mind, have they displaced a precariously placed literature? Are writers, lacking some greater if lethal faith, the new hostages? Is history possible? Is anyone serious? These are some of the questions posed by Mao Tu, the latest novel by Don DeLillo, who has already proved with such books as Players, White Noise, and Libra that no one can match his ability to let America, the bad dream of it, speak through his pen. Mao Tu takes its title from one of Andy Warhol's famous portraits of Mao Zedong. For DeLillo, the Warhols are more than mock chinoiserie. They anticipate the televised image of the official state portrait of Mao, defaced with red paint in Tiananmen Square. In Mao Tu, the Warhol pictures marry the ideas of totalitarianism and image-making, prompting speculation about how fame is transformed into a death mask, how a portrait can freeze the mind behind the face. Fittingly enough, the novel begins and ends with a wedding, that most stereotypically photographed occasion. And yet, while this bookending creates a palindromic comedy, these are anti-comedic, apocalyptic nuptials. Not that Mao Tu doesn't now and then attempt a joke. As with so much of DeLillo's work, the novel has a discursive sweep, and its narrative movement from serious idea to serious idea is rigorously unneat, like the gathering and dissociative movement of the brain itself. But as a story about a reclusive writer written by a reclusive writer, it has a sense of humor. Early on in the novel, a mad street person, great-maned and filthy, rimed saliva in his beard, old bruises across the forehead gone soft and crumbly, bursts into a bookstore. "I'm here to sign my books," he tells the security guard. Later, when the protagonist, a novelist named Bill Gray, falls into the company of a Maoist terrorist sympathizer, their tense conversation takes an unexpected turn. "There's something I wanted to ask the other evening at dinner," says the other man. "Do you use a word processor?" But overall, as one might expect from DeLillo, this is a dark tale, one that is focused on the writer Bill Gray and the various characters circling his life at a time when Gray is particularly weary of his well-guarded seclusion. Indeed, that seclusion has become a kind of captivity. In a way, he is looking for a changing of the guard. Thus Gray escapes the confines of his country home to visit a friend at a New York publishing house, then finds himself agreeing to go to London to give a reading on behalf of a poet held captive in Beirut. When he arrives in London, however, the reading is postponed because of a bomb threat. But Gray moves ineluctably toward the Middle East, via Athens and Cyprus, and toward the fate of the poet hostage, which, in an act of professional brotherhood, but also of spiritual mystery, Gray insists on trying to prevent or share or appropriate. In that contest between art and life, this is a scenario that both mirrors and is the master collapse that is Gray's final book. The people in Gray's life at this critical time include Scott, a compulsive and maniacal fan who has tracked Gray down and volunteered himself as an assistant, enforcing Gray's solitude, managing Gray's career, commanding Gray's life. There's also Scott's lover, the waif-like Karen, who is sometimes Gray's lover as well, a former follower of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, with a visionary streak that allows her to see what others can't and to speak in eerie mimicry what others speak. And there is Britta, the literary photographer whose portraits of Gray, she and he both briefly believe, will help usher him out into the world of the living, though it is not long before she gives up photographing writers and turns to those who make the real news, the terrorists. DeLillo has written about terrorists before, in the 1977 novel Players, but Mao too has something else haunting it, the ordeal of Salman Rushdie. DeLillo shares a publisher with Rushdie, and in Mao too, the New York publishing house that Gray visits is one at which there are visitor searches and guards. The idea of a writer held hostage is so understandably traumatizing to DeLillo that he has used his narrative to work variations on this theme. The blindfolded poet in a basement in Beirut, the hermitic and professionally hamstrung novelist in a study in upstate New York. Unless the pairing seem merely a melodramatic metaphor, DeLillo, with a kind of insistence, makes these lives intersect. This can really happen, he seems to be saying. Look for a writer, and you will find a terrorist and a hostage. This is the new literary dialectic. It is also the evening news. No one's prose is better than DeLillo's. I'm a sentence maker, like a donut maker, only slower, says Bill Gray. DeLillo's depiction of a writer's face through the viewfinder of a camera becomes a poem complete unto itself. She watched him surrender his crisp gaze to a softening, a bright-eyed fear that seemed to tunnel out of childhood. It had the starkness of a last prayer. She worked to get at it. His face was drained and slack, coming into flatness, into black and white, cracked lips and flaring brows, age lines that hinged the chin, old bafflements and regrets. The novel is also filled with set pieces that show off the author's great skill with a scene and with multiple points of view. There is, for example, the Orwellian opening, a mass wedding of 13,000 at Yankee Stadium. It's as though they designed this to the maximum degree of let the relatives squirm, says one of the flesh parents, futilely scanning the bridal veils for her daughter. How they hate our willingness to work and struggle, thinks Karen, the daughter she is looking for. They want to snatch us back to the land of lawns. When toward the end of the novel, DeLillo has Bill Gray, who was suffering internal injuries from a hit-and-run accident in Athens, sit down in a Cyprus restaurant to make witty, if coded, chit-chat with some British tourists. It is a portrait of the artist as the dying Mercutio, and it provides the book some of its best dialogue, speech that sounds like speech rather than writing. Often in the complex orchestration of his ideas, DeLillo makes his characters name and sing all his tunes for him, speaking in dazzling chunks of authorial essay that read as if they had been created by someone who no longer cared how people really spoke. Here, though, in this careful, bitter dinner scene, everything, the tension, the tone, the dialogue, is exactly right. Among the myriad other things to admire in Mao too are DeLillo's way of capturing a representative slice of a city, his ability to reproduce ineffable urban rhythms, his startling evocations of sights and smells. He has a discerning and satirical eye which notes unexpected details, like Gray's sepia toenails or the cancer coloring book in the pocket of a car door. Indeed, it is to the larger idea of the image, its use as a bridge between public and private, its doubtful integrity, its sanctimonious politics, that Mao Tu keeps returning. A mass wedding, a photo session with a writer, an international revolution, all attempt an elimination of the self through the imagistic replication of the self. Seen this way, imagery is a kind of cemetery, a repository for the proliferating residue of life. The room drained the longings out of him, DeLillo writes of the hostage poet in that basement cell. He was left with images. In DeLillo's metaphorical system, the self figured and multiplied is death. An army is the opposite of a person. Likeness is the canvas of farewell. Only anarchic Beirut seems to have consumed all its own depictions. Gray has trouble even finding a map of the place. If one remains less moved by Mao Tu than engaged and impressed, that is the contract a reader must often make with a book by DeLillo. He is seldom an emotional writer. Nonetheless, one may find oneself hoping, just a little, for something approximating the feeling and power of, say, Marguerite Oswald's monologue in the closing chapter of Libra, or even the chill gallows humor of White Noise, which accomplished so much sustained and mournful queasiness. Still, within its own defined parameters, within the boundaries of its own paradoxical discourse, DeLillo's new book succeeds as brilliantly as any of his others. One thinks of the novel's own refrains, Bill Gray's memory of a family joke, repeating the instructions in the hat section of a Sears catalog, measure your head before ordering, and the prayerful chant of an unheeded street beggar, still love you, spare a little change, still love you. 1991. Election Day 1992. Voters in Wonderland. Is it too late to note the left-handedness of all three candidates? It left, so to speak, an eerie impression. Not because of the various primitive biases against left-handedness, that it is sinister, like the Italian word sinistra, or clumsy, like the French, gauche, or that it suggests a brain organized in mystery and improvisation. No, mostly it was eerie because in watching the candidates, it seemed we were viewing a reflection in the mirror, as if this were all taking place through the looking glass, and that Lewis Carolian quality was unnerving, particularly given the people involved. I guess I mean the American people, a phrase I hoped never to hear again, but there it is, and without a southern drawl, a Texas twang, or a Camp David scoff. The American people, so fickle and unimpressed. What do they want? As I watched them being courted these many months, it occurred to me that the three candidates really were suitors, that they had courting styles, attitudes, and tricks. They were trying to get a date, November 3rd, with the American people. Bill Clinton was the etchings man, the guy with the soulful but collegiate gaze, the curly mouth, such heat in the face and itchy restlessness in a suit. It seemed his clothes would fly off him. At his place there were jazz recordings and art. It's time for a change, he said, looking around the joint. Ross Perot came straight to the front door and rang the bell. I'm crazy about you. That's all there is to it. The American people noted the adjective, but were charmed. When he skipped town for the wedding of a relative, they blew their noses and began seeing other men. When 2 months later he showed up again at their office, the American people phoned 911. Of course, they misdialed and got 411, information, infomercial. George Bush promised safety. I won't drink and drive. Not like you know who. But the trunk of his car was locked. Panamanian drugs? Deposit slips from Iraqi banks? Copies of Hamlet? Of Richard II? It was painful to watch them in Richmond negotiate the stools. The informal seating of the second debate was daytime talk show theater, Oprah Winfrey, Phil Donahue, and this staging, somehow paradigmatic of the entire campaign, seemed particularly uncomfortable to President Bush, Bachelor Number One. Stealing that vulgar format for a debate was a kind of beheading, and Bush seemed to know that. He arrived anesthetized. He was too proud to flirt. He threw in the towel and waved to his wife in the audience. "Hi, honey." He was still trying to figure out how Ronald Reagan had gotten away with sitting around doing nothing, but when he, Bush, had tried it, he got nailed. It's so unfair. "Hi, honey." Clinton remained hunched over on his own stool, but then rose like a torch singer when it was his turn, microphone in hand, giving himself in the style of Piaf or Garland to each questioner. A cross between a sweet cocktail and a legal pad, he bespoke desire and its difficult math. Perot, meanwhile, used his stool as a kind of elevator shoe and seemed amused at his newly acquired stature. He worked up a running gag with the commander-in-chief. He had fun. Heck, look what he was doing. He was running for president. But this was all taking place through the looking glass, in some other world, that Lewis Carroll world, wasn't it? Is this longest and dreariest of courtships, the televised flattery, the bad candy, the shifting hairstyles, the future of presidential campaigning? I'm reminded of a remark made once by a transvestite turned transsexual. "When I was a transvestite," she said, "dressing up like this was fun. But now that I'm a woman, it's such a chore." In the world of Lewis Carroll, strangeness and vanity are laws of physics. Smiles linger in the air. Cakes are marked "eat me" beautifully in currants. Turtles croon of their own soup. But after the election, whoever is our president is going to have to pass through the thick silver mist of the mirror into our side, the American people's side, the real side of the room. 1992. Charles Baxter's Shadow Play. Often when short story writers go to write novels, they get jaunty. They take deep breaths and become brazen, the way shy people do on wine. Donald Bartlemy becomes mythic and parodic. Alice Munro boldly seamsterly, stitching novels from short stories. Andre Debuse asks us to reconsider the novella as an equivalent form. Perhaps Grace Paley has shown the greatest bravado of all in simply not bothering. Charles Baxter, whose three brilliant collections of short stories, Harmony of the World, Through the Safety Net, and A Relative Stranger, may place him in the same rank as the above writers, constructed his first novel in reverse chronology. First Light, 1987, the hauntingly detailed story of a brother and sister from Five Oaks, Michigan, is an intricate unknotting, a narrative progression backward in time toward the moment when the boy, Hugh, first touches his infant sister's hand. It is a strategy intended, no doubt, to make the genre Baxter's own, as well as to show the inextricability of sibling ties. Now, in his second novel, Shadow Play, Baxter has returned to Five Oaks, a town of prideful lies, sun-smelted ponds, and apples dry-rotting in the hot dust of the driveway, as well as to the subject of siblings and inextricability. Perhaps because he's been here before, Baxter is more confident this time. In Shadow Play, the novel is no longer a form to be seized and remade, but a capacious place in which to move around. Baxter is looser, less strict. The narrative has not been trained. Baxter indulges it, affectionately musses its hair, lets it go where it may. The result is paradoxically both a more conventionally constructed novel and a more surprising and suspenseful book. Shadow Play is primarily the story of Wyatt Palmer, a fiercely bright and artistic boy who grows up to find himself stuck in the most pedestrian of existences. By day, a bored government bureaucrat, by night, a tired husband, father, and homeowner. When a chemical company called Waldchem sets itself up in town and pressures the city management, for the sake of the local economy, of course, to look the other way, as health regulations are violated, Wyatt is suddenly and precariously placed at the center of a drama involving ethical behavior in post-ethical times. In a contracting economy, too many citizens of Five Oaks appear willing to make a devil's pact. Health for cash, lives for jobs. As assistant city manager, Wyatt would like to notify the state that the on-site waste management guidelines and regulations and licensing restrictions are being violated. But the head of Waldchem is a high school buddy. Wyatt plays golf with him. He has given Wyatt's wayward foster brother, Cyril, a job in the plant. And as the city manager tells Wyatt, the times are against you. By remaining quiet and polite and helpful to those around him, Wyatt strikes a most unholy bargain, with himself as well as with the world. He is no longer his troubled brother's troubled keeper. He is a member of the audience. As Baxter wrote in First Light, "No one knows how to do that in this country, how to be a brother." Not unlike Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, Baxter's shadow play takes large themes of good and evil and primitive deal-making and situates them in municipal terms and local ritual. He's interested in those shadowy corners of civilization in which barbarity manages to nestle and thrive. The America of this book has become a kind of hell. The houses gave off a dingy little light, the light of "I'm not sorry for anything," the light of "listen to me." That way you didn't even need eternal fire. Shadow Play is also an examination of how the Midwestern values of niceness, passivity, helpfulness, and just going along can contribute to the rot and demise of a community. When Wyatt's foster brother develops lung cancer while holding down his custodial job at the plant, Wyatt is impassive. "They didn't have to make Waldchem so dangerous, those bastards," rages the dying Cyril. "They could have made it safer." "You smoked, Cyril," Wyatt replies quietly. "You smoked cigarettes all your life." It is a response so wicked in its neutrality that later, he stood in his own living room, repressing the impulse to scream. The verdict on him, he now knew, was that he was obliging and careless, an accessory. When Wyatt agrees to help Cyril commit suicide, one is reminded here of a fellow Michigander, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, he has not only enacted the central metaphor of the book, but effectively set himself up for a nervous breakdown, one replete with tattoo, adultery, arson, and a move to Brooklyn. This last is no amusing little Philip. In the geographical paradigm of Baxter's book, New York City is Eden as anti-Eden. Here the fruit of the tree of knowledge is not rotting in anyone's driveway. There are no driveways. The trees were cut down years ago. The good fight has long since been waged and lost, and here one can live in something akin to aftermath, if not to peace. As a boy, Wyatt had memorized a map of the New York subway system, and as a young man he was an artist, a painter of shadow portraits. Now, in New York with his family, he can resume where he left off before the heart and hinterland so rudely interrupted him. He can attempt something un-Midwestern, something like a coda, a Twilight sequel, in unecological times, an ecology of hope and loss. One of Charles Baxter's great strengths as a writer has always been his ability to capture the stranded inner lives of the Midwest's repressed eccentrics. And here, in his second novel, he is at full throttle. The character of Wyatt's mother is a figure of alleged madness, but whether it speaks to Baxter's talent or should be cause for this reader's concern, the passages that give voice to her insanity are lucid, lovely, sympathetic. She knew that birds sometimes agreed or disagreed with their names, but she kept that information to herself. "Angels," she thinks, "were so vain, so pretty. They wore coral earrings and distressfully unassembled hats." When Wyatt brings his mother to New York, and she finds the life of a bag lady a congenial one, Baxter treats this with a certain heartening dignity, rather than a forlorn condescension. He also gives much of the book over to the voice and point of view of Wyatt's bright, quirky Aunt Ellen, who functions as a sapient observer of the world of the novel. She believes not in a benevolent god, but in a god of pure curiosity. Moreover, she believes she is writing the Bible of that god. "There is absolutely no love coming to us from that realm," she says of the more traditional deity. "None at all. You might as well pray to a telephone pole." Aunt Ellen, even more than Wyatt, is the moral center of the book. Hers is the most trenchant of the solitudes fashioned and recorded here. That Baxter can traverse gender and offer such a deep and authentic rendition of a woman's voice and thoughts should not in itself be remarkable in contemporary fiction, yet still, it is. Because his work doesn't offer itself up in gaudy ways for popular consumption or intellectual play, theorists and critics have failed to descend en masse with their scissors and forks, Charles Baxter has acquired the reputation of being that rare and pleasurable thing, a writer's writer. He has steadily taken beautiful and precise language and gone into the ordinary and secret places of people, their moral and emotional quandaries, their typical American circumstances, their burning intelligence, their negotiations with what is trapped, stunted, violent, sustaining, decent, or miraculous in their lives. In writing about ordinary people, he derives narrative authority from having imagined further and more profoundly than we have, making his literary presence a necessary and important one, and making Shadow Play a novel that is big, moving, rich with life and story. Something so much more than a writer's anxious vacation from shorter forms. 1993. Margaret Atwood's The Robber Bride. Margaret Atwood has always possessed a tribal bent. In both her fiction and her nonfiction, she has described and transcribed the ceremonies and experience of being a woman, or a Canadian, or a writer, or all three. And as with so many practitioners of identity politics, literary or otherwise, while one side of her banner defiantly exclaims, "We are," the other side, equally defiant, admonishes, "Don't lump us." In The Robber Bride, Atwood has gathered, not lumped, four very different women characters. Probably it is the subject of women that has most completely dominated Atwood's novels, although, for women, one might as well read a medium-sized variety of people in general. That women are individuals, difficult to corral, a motley and uneasy sisterhood, that feminism is often hard-going and hard-won, sabotaged from within as well as without, that in the war between the sexes there are collaborators as well as enemies, spies, refugees, spectators, and conscientious objectors, all this has been brilliantly dramatized in Atwood's work. The cruel Toronto girlhoods depicted in her novels Lady Oracle and Cat's Eye, replete with vague, insensitive mothers and sadistic girls, are in their way feminist dystopias akin to the totalitarian North America of her best-known work, the futurist novel The Handmaid's Tale. To restore the humanity of their cultural representation, Atwood's writing suggests, it is women who must look at women in discreet and unsentimental ways. Too often men are in power, or love, or the dark, or the doghouse, or the fog. So the attentive Atwood looks, and the women she sees are deformed by their own niceness, or given to mischief, or dreaminess, or carelessness. In a sexist society, they meekly but inventively improvise a life. Or else they pounce and grab. Some work hard. Some yell. Some hide. Some march. Some drink. Some fib. Some bite the dust, the bullet, the hand that feeds them. Some rule the roost. Some count their chickens before they're hatched. Goodness, what a richly hued tapestry of women the world has woven! That this should in any way still be news tells us something of the condescension and categorical thinking of that world. In a recent introduction to the Paris Review anthology, Women Writers at Work, Atwood remarked that the editors chose to bring together 15 diverse writers over what